happen over a 15 or a 30 year life, and you're not essentially depreciating. That's what an obsolescence reserve is. If you're not reserving that allowance for obsolescence on the inventory side, after that asset is retired 30 years from now, you could get hit with a big write-off of the associated inventory. So a lot of my utility clients are starting, I've been encouraging them, they're getting there, starting to match the inventory with their, you know, a gen set or a near case turbine sets or whatever you've got in place at the plant itself, and then building these obsolescence reserve over time. So every year you're getting hit as members just a little bit, and at the end there's no value left. And so even if that spare is never used, at least you have it there as an insurance policy, and at least you're not getting hit with it in 1 year period of time. 30 years down the road, you're taking that cost over time. So there's my
thank you. Thank you for that, Joy.
Yeah.
Jeremy, I see your heavy hand up.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I just had a quick question with regard to definition of inventory, just for clarity.
Well, that's a great question. I will do my best to answer it. So capital is the opposite. So there's two, you know, everything you have is either going to be in construction in progress and ultimately a capital asset, or it's going to be an inventory, which is used for repair and maintenance, typically speaking, or used to eventually go into a capital asset. So if it's assigned to a specific project, you can buy something like line or cable or something like that as part of a big project. And if that project is still in process, right, you can put it in construction in progress, not in inventory, because it's part of that project. You bought it for that project. It's meant to be used for that project. You're anticipating using it. As soon as that project is completed, that's when the decision gets made for things that are questionable. Is this actually used and useful? Is this item being used and is it useful? Then you place it into service in capital assets. So if at the end of your project, you end up with, you know, 1,000 feet of cable, but you want to keep that for repairs for some reason, right? That 1,000 feet of cable in theory would go back into inventory. And when it's used for a repair, then you expense it as it's used. You know, we see this a lot with poles, where somebody is doing a huge transmission project and they buy all these poles for the transmission project, but maybe they buy a surplus because they're already shipping it and, you know, they already have that. So at the end of the day, when the transmission project is turned on, they have, you know, 100 poles left that go back in inventory, but you don't want to get rid of those. You know, a pole could fall down. You might need it. When that pole is then used, then that's expense to repair and maintenance, you know, to your transmission maintenance expense accounts. So it's held until it's used. And if it's used and useful for a long-term period of time, then it's typically capitalized. If it's just repairing or replacing an existing asset, you know, one for one, then you wouldn't capitalize it. You would expense it.
Thank you for that explanation. The reason I ask is because inventory can run all the way down to small components and pieces. And I wanted to have an idea of, when we talk about inventory at SEPA, what that actually means for them and their effort to maintain that.
So. Right. And I will tell you, in the state of Alaska, there's a lot of diversity in the way that inventory is managed. In fact, some entities have what they call capital inventory, which doesn't exist, but they do that because it's associated with a capital asset, like a generator. And so the associated genset or parts are actually capitalized. So they have it in inventory when they do their count, but it's actually sitting on the balance sheet in capital assets. But, you know, but for various operational reasons, you want to know what's there and you want to have it counted, right? You want to make sure it's still available in good working order, all of those things. Because part of inventory is also looking at operational ability. You know, are you able to use it? And I see this all the time where people have wires, all sorts of transformers, all these things. But when somebody actually wants to do something, they're going to buy a new one instead of using what's in inventory. Because, well, the new technology is better, or this one's shinier and I want to use the new one. Or sometimes it's cheaper. The technology has gotten to where, you know, the one we bought 10 years ago is actually in inventory at a higher value than the one I want to buy. So why would I use the one in inventory? Well, because you already bought it. And so it's better for you as a company. And if you're not going to use it, you might as well write it off. So there's a lot of nuances to inventory we don't need to go into now, but it can be a fun topic and usually a little bit of a disconnect between what finance is trying to do and what operations is actually doing.
Thank you.
So with that, I think that would be a good future discussion with board in regards to inventory, because we have some critical inventory that pertains to a particular machine or generator. Because if we were to have a catastrophic failure, the lag time between getting a new product manufactured as to using the one that we may have in inventory is a big issue for us. And how we view those items, for instance, we are presently talking about a spare submarine cable, which could have a value of $4.5 million that could be utilized in any of the submarine crossings that we would have. Because if we have a catastrophic failure of two legs, then we're out of power on that particular segment. And how we put that inventory and how we capitalize it's going to be important because of the cost of that asset. So I think it's a good conversation moving forward as we set up this. And there's also, as Jeremy said, very small items that we would consider expendable, such as oils and filters and other things that have a rotational basis that may be just viewed as normal business operations. I don't know how that works, but I appreciate that. And I'd like to look forward to a conversation on the inventory.
Sure, and I'm happy to participate in that. As an example, a utility here in Anchorage, who shall remain nameless, they inventory every shovel because I think they've had trouble with theft and things disappearing from the warehouse. So if somebody wants a shovel, they have to go there and ask for a shovel. But the shovel is not on their books as an inventory item. You know, it's just part of the, you know, the repair and maintenance supply that they have. It's a supply, but they still kind of monitor really closely. But on the books and records, Kay would not have to actually track that. So, you know, there can be five or so different levels of inventory, and the accounting for them could be somewhat different, just depending on whether it's a, you know, a part or a spare for something that is in existence, or if it's a gen set, or if it's, you know, whatever it is that the item is, or a broom, you know.
We have a lot of those items here at KPU that are NOI, not on inventory, but they still stock them in the warehouse.
Yep.
So with that, I think that's for a bigger discussion later on. So if we can continue on with the audit presentation, that'd be good.
Yeah. I will turn to the financial statements now that Joy is presenting. So it will be presenting 3 years of audited financial information this year. Next year, we'll go back to presenting two full years, thankfully. The first thing I would like to take a look at is the audit opinion, which will be on page one here. And in this, we document what our responsibilities are, what management's responsibilities are, and then we, what our opinion of the financial statements were. So, in this paragraph here, you can see that we expressed an unmodified opinion over the financial statements, and all the financial statements. The other thing we are required to do, since you guys follow government auditing standards, is we issue an opinion over the gas financial statements, or the gas opinion. So that you'll see in right there. So we issued an unmodified opinion over both, which is great news.
Well, one thing I'll note here, for those of you who are, you know, studiers of audit opinions, it looks different this year. We adopted a new auditing standard. It doesn't affect you. It affects us. And it doesn't affect the way we actually do the audit. But the opinion is supposedly easier to read. So this is going to be a fun thing for you to do in all your spare time. It has the opinion at the beginning now. And then it talks about how we came about the opinion. What standards did we follow? What were management's responsibilities? This is actually the most interesting part under auditor's responsibilities, it's a lot more expanded now to explain to you what an audit is and what it's not. So, you know, this is a good place to refer back to if you're ever not sure of what's all involved in an audit. The audit opinion now does a much more expansive explanation for what's involved in the course of an audit. So this is a new audit standard that we implemented as a firm this year.
Thank you, Joy. And then the next section is the MD&A, which is prepared by Kay and Trey. I will not be going through this. I think it's a very important read and everyone should take the time to read through it. But this is prepared by management. It is not audited. It is tied to our audited numbers, but it's not part of our audited financials. But there's a lot of great information in there, and Kay puts a lot of effort into preparing this for the financials. So highly recommend reading through that.
Yeah, and keep in mind the MD&A, so the financial statements are factual. This is what actually were the numbers. These are the notes that support them. The MD&A allows management to give you more color, the why, you know, what's actually happening, what did they do, what capital assets did they build. So this is probably the best way to get the kind of the color of what happened and what some of these things are. So if you have questions as you look at financials, that's a good place to look, as Travis said.
Okay. Then if we turn to the statement of net position on page 16, this is the statement, all the assets and liabilities held by the company as of December 31st, 2020. This gives you a good idea of kind of just how the entity is doing. One thing I always take a look at is kind of the current assets and current liabilities, making sure you guys have a great, and you guys do have a great ratio. There should be no issue going forward making payments on either debt or other expenditures that you have incurred. If we go back to assets, as you can see, majority of this is all in capital assets. Yeah, I guess I'm jumping around a little bit. Sorry, Chai. Capital assets. So that makes up roughly 80% of your total assets and deferred outflows or resources. There wasn't really any significant changes. There was a jump in AR this year, which was just AR from your members. So the amounts due from the three members was higher as of December 31st this year. Everything else stayed pretty consistent this year. And and then as far as liabilities, nothing really too crazy this year. Paid down some debt, which is what you see as far as the decrease in your long-term debt at this point. So this is just your typical principal, your payments on debt. The bond issuance premium is amortized over the life of the bond. So that's the decrease there. In the net position section down here, you will note that you do have some restricted net assets, net position, which are related to either the debt service bonds required to have a certain balance at your end, and you're not allowed to have that drop below it. It'll be further disclosed in the footnotes. We'll get there. And then the restricted by agreements is related to is payments that you receive from Copper Valley Electric and Kodiak Electric with regards to an agreement that's in place. And that'll be disclosed further in the notes as well. It's great to see a lot of unrestricted funds too, very healthy. So that's money that the entity is free, has available to them, or that is available to them. Any questions on the balance sheet?
So, Travis, just in general, CEPA receives its revenues based on 6.8 cents a kilowatt. And as you do the audit and you look at the financials, if there was a concern that the rate per kilowatt hour wasn't meeting the needs of the operation of SEPA. How would you address that in a standard audit?
That would show up on the income statement. It would show up on the income statement and your operating income and losses. So you would recover, you would adjust the rates there. So if the rates weren't sufficient to support the SEPA's operations, you would see it here on the income statement. And one thing to note on that though is this operating income can kind of, it's not deceiving, but it's, you always got to look at this depreciation number too, because that's the bulk of your expenses, and that's not really a cash item. So these are capital assets that you have purchased in the past, and we're just depreciating them over the life of the asset. So that's typically your largest expense every year. So as far as a cash flow per point of view, operations look pretty healthy. But when you look at your income statement, it can, when it's just your expenses, including depreciation, it shows that they're not generating significant income.
Right. So it just depends on if you are trying to save for future capital replacement. That's really one of the reasons that you would maybe try to recover some portion of the depreciation. The other thing is you have to cover your debt load. So this operating income has to cover enough for your interest payment and your principal payment. Your principal payment is just over $800,000. But as Travis said, you've got almost $5 million of non-cash expenses. So, you know, the next statement actually is a cash flow statement. That's really what people are often drawn to, because if you look at, and not to steal Travis's thunder from later, but you're generating a lot of cash from operations, but you're using that cash to pay for principal and interest payments on debt and to invest in more utility plant, which is what you are wanting to do. Right. So there's always that balance between do we pay for depreciation in order to pay for debt and to pay for capital assets so we don't have to take out more debt. Right. There's a little bit of a balancing act there. And if you look back in 2019, which this is a 12 month period, this is only 6 months, but 2019, you know, we're generating a lot less of cash flow, not even enough to cover your principal and interest payment on your debt. So that would have been, in my mind, maybe not enough coming from operations in 2019. For 2020 now, you're generating enough where you still need to do, eat into your cash reserves, to pay for your capital, because you're building $2.4 million of capital assets here in this year. But you're generating more from operations, which allows you to do that. So, there's a bit of a balance between debt, cash flow and depreciation. That is a game that everybody plays. If you're building some asset and you place it in service and it's a pretty long-term sustainable capital plan where you're not building huge assets, anymore, more like a mature type of project, then you typically try to match your debt load with your depreciation net of grants. So there's that to consider too. I'm sure I just confused a few people, but I will say you just have to generate enough cash to cover your debt for sure, and ideally at least a portion of your capital asset additions.
So thank you for that. That was a good explanation, but rather than do it year by year, would you do a 5-year average or something, because there's going to be years when we had the drought would probably reduce those revenues, or we had a big rain year where the local communities were generating their own, which affected our revenues. So I don't think that there's any one year that may determine that. I think I'd like to see it over a longer term so that you're running with a running average rather than a single year situation.
And that would certainly help you with rate shock too, at a member level. If you had more of a longer term plan, it just means sometimes you'll have a surplus here at SEPA and sometimes a deficit. And so you've typically sort of smoothed those with rebates is kind of how you've managed that in the past. But it's certainly something that you could do. An average would be a good way of trying to come up with a long-term sustainable plan, just accounting for the fact that changes in debt might require more cash than you have in prior years.
Yeah, so we took on significantly more debt when we did the submarine cable. And so we have stopped the rebate system because we're utilizing those for SEPA operations and assets. And so I'd rather be ahead of the curve than behind the curve. So I like to see the forward planning if we and stay away from the rate shock issue. I'd hate to get us into a situation where we're trying to play catch up. So the audited finances or the finances as we see them is an indicator is are we right at that level where it's marginal and we may need to raise them? Are we in a situation where we can go for another 5 years and I'm just trying to see if that comes to light in the audited financials. So.
So Bob, if I could jump in here just for a second.
Trey, your audio is kind of getting broke up.
My audio is getting broken up?
You're talking underwater. Go ahead. I can hear you.
I don't know why. I haven't changed anything. So we typically try to bring forward, and we'll get into this discussion a little bit later. Am I really muffled? Get some funny looks.
Yeah, I think people are having a hard time understanding you, Trey. I don't know what happened to your mic at this particular point in time, and I don't know if you want to go into one of the other offices to make your statement, and we can look at that at the break.
I'm gonna drop off and just chime back in real quick.
Okay, we'll wait for you. Thank you.
Well, while we're waiting for Trey, one thing that I'll just point out, and I've pointed this out to him before, is, you know, if you look at your operating and general and administrative expenses, this kind of approximately $6.5 million, without the depreciation, I kind of take that number plus my interest. So you're at about $7 million right there. You know, and then you look at what's in your unrestricted net position. You do have, you know, quite a few months of sort of working capital available for you in terms of the number of months of expenses. So that's where when Travis was saying that unrestricted net position looks pretty strong, you know, it depends on the utility, but I would say having two years, in your case, 3 years of those costs, you know, available in unrestricted, it certainly gives you the flexibility to absorb some of that rate shock.
So is that better now?
Yes.
All right. Sorry, I missed that last little bit there, Joy, but I just wanted to make a couple of points, and we're going to have a little broader discussion on this on a discussion item coming up on a wholesale power rate a little bit later today. But in just overall terms, first of all, kind of looking at these financials being presented right now, they're going to be a little bit skewed over what our averages are. You know, we had the anomaly year in there where our revenue swung wildly. We didn't make our planned payments into the dedicated R&R fund part of the time. So there's going to be some things that where you're to your point, Bob, where you're asking about is there a way that, you know, should we be averaging this over years and this, that, and the other? I'll say that this little snapshot that we're looking at now will wildly swing those numbers. But from a planning perspective and as it pertains to the financials, is, you know, we try to present a balanced budget. And, you know, we've got some variables this year that are, I'll say, unusual a bit. We, you know, we have a pending insurance payout, and we just did some bonding for added debt service and such. So those are kind of, you know, and we have some other things on the income side that'll show up a little bit different on the books. But just from a basic fundamental, I mean, we shouldn't be budgeting in the red every year just because we have some cash sitting on the books. So from a long-term perspective, that's not sustainable. So anyway, we'll get into that a little bit more, but I just kind of wanted to add a little bit of flavor, to kind of our management approach to budgeting and the finances and trying to keep things evened out. And it will take a few months for all of these elements that I just kind of touched on to kind of smooth out and, you know, for invoices to get paid, for insurance claims to get settled and things of that nature.
Thank you for that, Trey. And that's what I was getting at is how we go about evaluating the rate structure in regards to our operations. And I know that there are things such as not making the payments into certain funds or anomalies that we may have. But I think trying to set up the board a little bit to better understand these financials and how they play out in regards to whether we need or we don't need a raise or what that raise actually should be. So I appreciate that we have Joy online right now and give us a little bit of a background on how some of that stuff works. So thank you.
All right. With that, I'll continue on with the statement of revenue and expenses. When you're looking at this and kind of comparing them this year, I would tend to look at the current year column and then the other 12-month period. When you look at the 6-month period, you can see that revenue jumped significantly, but that's just due to it being a shorter period. With that being said, revenue is up this year kind of from the last full 6 or 12-month period. And that was due to the June 30, 2019 period being a drought. If you look further back, it looks like this year's kind of consistent with what it had been historically. We kind of already touched on how the operating income, and how depreciation makes up the bulk of your operating expense and whatnot. And as far as the cash flow purposes, that this number really isn't a cash item. At the end of the day, with kind of you did get some other revenue as far as just some investment income from the investments you hold and then a few small grants, it looks like. But at the end of the day, it looks like you guys broke about even, which seems is kind of the goal for the members in SEPA. And then as far as the cash flow, I'll switch over to the cash flow. So this, as Joy mentioned, kind of just breaks down where you guys are getting money from and what you're spending money on. So that first line there is just the revenue you've received from your members. And then the next two breaks down the cash you're spending to get that cash, or to produce that cash. Financing activity is pretty minimal. I will draw attention to the purchase of capital assets this year. You guys did spend significant money on capital assets. Most of that is related to the Swan Lake housing project, that you guys have going on. And then the other funding, as Joy mentioned, is due to the payment of your debt and the interest related to that. The investing activities breaks down just the buying and selling of securities. A lot of this is just related to you'll sell and buy. You're not so much selling and buying securities, they're just in funds being reallocated, I guess, to diversify your risk. So these numbers look very high, but they're just the activity within the investment account, I guess.
Yeah, certain bonds are close to maturity, and so you sell those and buy new ones. It's pretty common. Yeah. But you can see how much actual activity you're money manager types are doing. So they do monitor those and check your risks pretty frequently.
And at the end of the year, you guys ended with a net $500,000 in increase in cash. So nicely done there. The next just kind of goes through a reconciliation of the operating activities. Nothing really jumps out there. You can see that depreciation's the big number in there. And then this, the rest of this is just the changes on the balance sheet from year to year. I'll go to the notes of the financial statements. This first note is just a background of the organization, how it's incorporated and whatnot. Note two is, I believe, one of the more important notes in the financials. It lists all the policies that the company has adopted and how things are being accounted for. I think this is a good read to understand the accounting within and how we're coming up with the numbers. For example, this capital asset one, this is, we had mentioned the estimated useful life. So this was an estimate that had been mentioned in the wrap-up doc. So this is exactly how management has determined the useful life of their assets, or how they're recognizing revenue and so on and so forth. There's been no new changes to this. This is consistent with prior year. There are some new accounting pronouncements coming up. The big one will be the leases, which comes into effect next year for you guys. So if there's any leases that you guys have, they'll have to go as an asset and a liability. So it doesn't really change. It's just now to clarify or to further disclose what future payments you have. And then there's some other ones that are coming up as well. You can read through those. I don't think all those will be applicable. The next one is the cash footnote, which is quite the footnote. There's a lot of information in here. There's the unrestricted. So on the balance sheet you can see this kind of breaks down how your unrestricted funds are invested versus what your restricted funds consist of. So this just shows and what fund they are actually invested in. So as you can see, most of your restricted ones are related to the bond and bond requirements to have reserves for those. And then the contingency fund, which just in case of emergency or for a disaster you guys have. And furthermore, we break down the risk. So we're required to break down like credit risk or inherent risk of the investments and how risky the investments are. The longer the investment is, so you can see in the chart above that there's 1 year or 1 to 5 years or less than 1 year and 1 to 5 years. The shorter term investments are typically safer just due to a period of time. So this presents that. And it also breaks down by category what you guys are invested in. As you can see, a lot of demand deposits and then U.S. government bonds. If you scroll down, this shows your investments and the rating of each investment. You guys are pretty conservative, investing in pretty safe securities and bonds and whatnot. But this breaks down that information. We can skip to that capital asset footnote now, and this just further breaks down the line item on the balance sheet that shows by location. What the capital assets are, and then the depreciation for the year. On the financial statement, you'll see the face of the financials. It'll show this net number, this 127 million, but this just further breaks it down for informational purposes. If we scroll down some more. So the other long-term liabilities, this is related to PERS. There was some employees at the Tyee facility that were state employees and were covered under PERS, and when SEPA purchased them, there's now a liability for SEPA to make payments back into the PERS system. So you'll see there's a liability on the balance sheet for that.
And then, I think they were technically Wrangell employees, but yes, they were PERS participants. So you are paying that PERS liability.
Okay. And then the DNR liability, which is related to the payments that you get, SEPA receives from Copper Valley and Kodiak Electric each year. So you'll see that it increases each year. Debt, you're down to two bonds now, and potentially three, it sounds like, going forward. But this schedule just breaks down the balance of each loan at the beginning balance. If you, had a new bond issuance, and then the payment. As you can see, the 2015 bond isn't in repayment status yet, or isn't being paid down yet. Leases. So this is where the new GASB 87 will come into effect. It'll pretty much put this information on your balance sheet or the face of the financials as an asset and a liability. It won't be a significant impact, but you'll see this number going forward. Employee benefit plans, SEPA does have two. They're involved in the IBEW, and there will be further disclosures. There's supplementary information about that. Commitment and contingencies, nothing there. We are required to still disclose on COVID. We looked into the impacts that COVID could potentially have on the entity. At this time, we don't believe there will be any material impacts or no going concern that we're aware of. SEPA seems to be able to continue as operate with their operations. And as mentioned, there's this related party footnote, which breaks down just the percent of revenue and AR for each of the members. And then this is as mentioned, the new bond issuance. We disclose this as a subsequent event. It happened after 12/31, and just to provide further clarity of the financial statements, the amount and the expected annual interest rate. This just further disclosed the pension plan. I'm not really going to go into it. It just shows how much is being contributed to each plan. If you have questions on that, we can discuss. And this is the gas auditing report. So, as mentioned, we performed our audit in line with the government auditing standards. This is similar to our opinion on the face of the financials, just over the compliance of your gas. Your gas compliance. So it breaks down, the purpose of the report, and then, but we identified no non-compliance during the year. So, which is great news.
That would be if you weren't filing your payroll taxes or you were out of compliance with your bond covenants. This is compliance with laws and regulations, and we look pretty carefully at that. Didn't identify any issues. We actually looked at your bond compliance covenants, what you've agreed to on the bonds, those kinds of things.
And this just shows that we had no internal just kind of summarize what we had discussed earlier, no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies or non-compliance. I know that was a lot of information. Any questions on the audit report?
Thank you, Travis. Thank you, Joy. Is there any question from members in regards to the presentation? Seeing and hearing none, I thank you again for your work, and especially I'd like to thank staff for what they do in regards to our finances to make sure that we have a clean audit at the end of the year. I know they're very due diligent in how they manage those and keep us well apprised of that. So if there are no other comments, we do have a motion on the floor. Is there any other questions? Hearing and seeing none, Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Bynum?
Yes.
Sievertson?
Yes.
Skillings?
Yes.
Hagerman?
Yes.
Kreisanka?
Yes.
Thank you.
Again, thank you, Travis, and thank you, Joy, for those reports and the information you provided.
Yeah, thank you. It's always a pleasure working with you and your team. Hope the rest of the day goes wonderfully.
Thank you.
Thanks, thank Joy. Thanks, Travis. Appreciate it. Bye.
So that, with that, we're about a half hour behind our schedule for a break. So at this particular point in time, if it's nothing else that you have to add at this time, Trey, we will take a short break.
When, that sounds great. When would you like to return?
So it's 10:58. We scheduled a 15-minute break. So let's come back at 11:15.
Great.
Thank you.
And you can stay online if you want, folks, and just keep connected, and we'll just
19th, and we're back on record. So we are on item 6, old business, item A, SEPA third quarter update of the operation plan. Trey.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of brief comments, and then I'll turn it over to Robert if he's got anything to add. But in short, you know, we've been spilling for months. We're nowhere near any of the curtailment curves or so. Any of that's just really not applicable at this point. I mean, we look really fat going into the rainy season. So we're going to continue to spill, in my opinion, for at least the next few months. At least till things lock up and the rain stops. So, but with the current forecast, I mean, all I see is rain for the next 10 days. So, I'll pitch it over to Robert to add any other comments he might have.
Yeah, I would say, really not much to report. With the lakes being full, as Trey mentioned, we're 77 feet above curtailment for Tyee in accordance with our operations plan for 2021. So we're not looking at any risk really for the turn. Typically in April timeframe is when we, what we're really forecasting, trying to make the turn such that we don't have to have supplemental diesel and SEPA can meet sales in accordance with our operations plan and our draft limits that the board sets every year. So yes, we're looking very healthy, and this is in part due to our incredible snowpack that we had from the 2020 to 2021 season, 200% above normal, as I reported in previous board meetings. And so that has really come off nicely this year. It can go a couple different ways where it melts all at once. We fill and we spill early, but we didn't really start spilling there till middle of July. And so we got to utilize a lot of that water, even though we're spilling now and we're not, that water that is spilled is not utilized. You know, with the dam raise project, we were able to capture running at elevation 343 and a half now, 13 and a half feet. And every time the lake goes up and we're not in spill, or that is actual water that is accounted for. So when we do our 2022 operations plan and I give the presentation on how ops total went for 2021 there in December and then again in February there, I'll go through that. I'll show, you know, what we saved or gained by having the dam raise project there at Swan Lake, what we gained, in efficiencies at Swan Lake, and how that all played out, you know, cause obviously if we ran super inefficient, we probably wouldn't be spilling or be full. And, but the way it looks now, we should be heading, we're in healthy condition. We should be heading into the fall, season when Tai starts to lock up and Swan starts to draft. We should be having plenty of water to make it through next year. That's kind of where we sit.
Robert, if I may, what is the elevation of, I guess, the top of the weir at Tai? Is that at?
That used to be 1396 is where we had it set before we had it. We had USGS come out and do another audit and they, or a survey, and it's at 1398.3. So that's the number we officially use as an organization for spill now, is 1398.3.
So just in an abstract, how much does each individual foot of rise at Tai give us in potential stored power? If we were to go above the 1398,
about 400 megawatt hours per foot, but it's not necessarily just 1 foot equals 400 and some change megawatt hours. Really, it's a function of lake level, but it's also the function of capacity. So you get twice that because you get it on the way up and you get it on the way down. So you almost get 800 megawatt hours per foot if you add elevation. To the lake.
Well, in a year like this year where the snow came out correctly and we have the incredible rains, as we look forward, and I know that when we originally did a bunch of studies in regards to our hydro, it was storage capacity. And being that there's that notch there, and I know there's a lot of karst and stuff underneath it, so it would be an incredible project if you ever undertook it. But would that be one of the, we gained efficiencies by putting the gates on Swan. Is there an efficiency to be had in the future, or what would be the process to raise that dam level X number of feet?
You mind if I go for that, Trey, or did you want to speak on that?
Go ahead, Robert.
Okay, so in our hydro site analysis, we actually look into as one of the options is doing a dam raise at Tai, and then we have another option of actually adding a third unit. If you remember, Tai does have a third bay, so it has another penstock and it has the ability to add another third unit. Those studies didn't really over the years. You average the spill. We might have a great spill this year, but we haven't had it. I mean, it hasn't been this much spill consistently. So when you start investing millions of dollars into, you know, raising the project and adding a unit, perhaps, you look at the averages. What can you rely on? And it didn't pan out as well as some of the other hydro sites. And that's something that we will get into again. I think we're going to talk a little bit in executive session today, but the thought, if it was consistently 200% and now 200% became average on the snowpack, that would pan out a lot differently in terms of the numbers. But we get these, you know, years of drought and then years of water. And, because the lakes are cyclical, it's a single year type thing. You use it or you lose it. There is no real benefit in, you know, spending $100 million on putting a dam at Tai, for example, because you're only gain 10 feet or whatever. So we could go through that, Bob, offline, but there is already documentation out there that does compare Tai to other sites.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Through the chair, clarification.
Yes.
So Robert, what you're saying is that this is a category that is evaluated and part of the hydro site analysis as an option.
Correct.
Thank you.
So I'll turn it over to Trey. I don't have anything else on the ops plan as of for now, but we will be going into the next few months, actually starting to develop the 2022 operations plan. And as part of that, we still consider loads. As you recall, we look at what potential future loads are. And as we go into the future, we start considering also potentials of interconnections if that occurs, or potential increased loads of interruptible loads. So that will start playing a role in the operations plan as well, but not for 2022. However, we'll start building the models just to incorporate them, so it's not a rush to try and get it incorporated.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'll move on to the next item for a discussion on the wholesale power rate update. I kind of touched on this just a little bit earlier in a couple of places so far this morning. So I just wanted to give an update on what my thoughts are with regard to a potential rate increase and the timing and some of the supporting information. Obviously, I will be providing another detailed write-up for our December board meeting for an action item for the board. But in short, I'll just reiterate that SEPA tries to budget a balanced budget. And over the past few years, we've shaved off in areas just to be able to present a balanced budget. And I think that's a reasonable approach to SEPA's financing our rates, I should say, and how we operate our finances. With that said, if we're currently and have been budgeting at balanced budgets, and we've had to shave off areas just to meet that, it's reasonable to assume that our revenues are reasonably well matched. As Joey mentioned, I mean, there's going to be fluctuations. We're going to have years where we have higher revenues than average, and then we're going to have years where we're going to have lower revenue than average. And we do our best to forecast what that looks like every year with the information we have at hand at that time. But there's just a few salient points that I think will help drive the board's decision ultimately in December. The first one is we just added additional debt service, around $785,000 a year. And to put that in perspective, a quarter of a cent increase will increase revenues on average, maybe about $400,000 a year. So that's almost a half cent increase, just to address the new debt service. And then later in the packet, we'll talk in greater depth on the vegetation management plan that I'm proposing. And I'm also proposing within that plan a more sustainable clearing plan, so we're not just in time clearing every year, and we catch up and we can have essentially a levelized payment into our vegetation clearing. And within that plan, I've suggested that approximately about $350,000 of additional spending will need to occur for vegetation clearing in order to achieve a sustainable plan. And then, just the overall elements that we've talked quite a bit with the board over the last couple of years, and that just has to do with general inflationary impacts. And we've talked about the need at a minimum of probably a quarter of a cent to address that. So just from a high level, I pretty much outlined a pretty a reasonable argument for a 1 cent increase over a certain period of time to address what will be essentially, fixed costs. So with that in mind, that's just something to think about as we get to December. I'll outline this and firm up the numbers for the board. But at this point, it would seem reasonable to maintain a balanced budget that, you know, we do need to start incrementally increasing the rates in order to achieve that. And that's really about all I was going to provide today, just an update. I mean, these are pretty big chunks of money that are new, and we're already operating on a balanced budget. So it's pretty clear to me, at least, that, you know, we're going to have to make some adjustments. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you for that, Trey. Does anybody have a question?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Jeremy.
Not really a question, I guess, more of a comment on the topic. I think it's an important topic, and it's definitely important to the organization that we maintain appropriate funding levels to stay balanced. And I think at the point that we push capital and or cut services through O&M, that it's harmful to the ratepayer. So I fully support the messaging that's being given to us. And I think that one thing that I would like us to see as we move forward, that as rates are coming, that, and we're going to be approving rate increases when and if that happens, that we have enough forecast time that when we make a yes on a rate increase, that effective rate will be out into the future far enough that our member utilities have an appropriate amount of time to incorporate those in their budgets. That would be my only comment. So if we have a potential rate increase coming at the next meeting, I think that's something that we, at least on the Ketchikan side, have anticipated in our rate schedule. But as future increments come, that we get ahead of those and that we know that those are going to be coming at a future date. Those are my only comments.
Thank you, Jeremy. Anybody else?
I'd just follow up with that a little bit and just say that, you know, we've been, I'll say, forecasting a rate increase for almost 2 years now. So I believe we've been very proactive in discussing this and the potential amounts. And we've had lengthy discussions on trying to do it small incremental amounts so it'll have the least impact. So I think we're doing all those things already, and certainly we'll continue to do so as we move forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
I just clarify, Trey. I make the comment because from a board perspective, if the board has a long-term discussion, you're telling us, we're going to need to be raising rates. We're going to need to be raising rates. And we sit and we just have a discussion and say, yeah, we know that we're going to be having to raise rates. That if we take action where a rate immediately goes into effect, we can then go back in and talk to our councils to effectively raise that rate. But as an example of what has happened is that back in June, the utility here in Ketchikan implemented a small rate increase to cover projection future rate increase from SEPA. Well, then the SEPA board did not take action on any kind of a rate increase with the assumption that we're still discussing it. We know that it's coming, and it leaves a perception in the public that isn't necessarily a good one, with regard to how those kinds of things go down. So all I'm saying is that we know that rate increases are coming, that if we approve them, we approve them with, enough time that the local bodies can then implement a rate in place prior to the SEPA rate going up. as an example, if we know that we've been talking about a rate increase that we want to have for next year, that 6 months out from that projection, that we actually approve the increase that will be effective 6 months from now or a year from now, or a schedule that shows that, so that when we go to our local elected body and forecast these rate increases, we don't just prematurely do them and then the SEPA board pushes it down the road for another year. It really puts us here at the utility at a disadvantage when we're trying to communicate to the public. That's my only messaging on that.
Thank you, Jeremy, and duly noted. I think that we took that action because SEPA was proactive in talking to us about it, but we are still waiting for the outcome of what the total cost of the bond was going to be and other things. So, but I certainly appreciate your position. Trey, do you have anything else?
No, I'll just add it. Just one thing that, you know, part of that deferment of the board, I think, was well founded because we were in the middle of COVID and the communities were struggling at that time. So, that was
absolutely sort
of part of the board's decision, I think, played into it anyway.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go right ahead, Carl.
Thank you. Just to kind of dovetail on that, Trey, acknowledge Jeremy's comments. I agree with where he's going with that. It's the timing on these things is very difficult for local utilities to respond to. And so I guess my question to Trey is, I'll look forward to the information in December and action item. Do you anticipate that the request to the board in December will be for an immediate rate increase, or will it be a schedule of rate increases over the next several years?
I think that's going to be a discussion topic for the board at that time. I don't want to make a predetermination on what the board would decide. I've just kind of laid out right for you today that, you know, really it's going to take a 1 cent increase. But how we get to there, you know, do you do one every 6 months? Do you do one every year? And of course that's just with what we currently know. That strategy certainly will be something that I'll make a recommendation to the board and the board will discuss it and figure out a path forward on how to address that.
Good enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Anybody else? As that was only a discussion item, we'll go ahead and move on to item C, discussion, second revision to the iPad policies.
Okay, I'll jump in here, Mr. Chair. The SEPA staff brought an alternative policy for digital communications device to the board in an attempt to address a couple of issues that we were having with the old policy. And frankly, it just got a little overly complicated. And I think my recommendation to the board is that we just maintain the current policy and we'll just manage that appropriately. I think we've got enough flexibility to deal with it. The biggest issue is when we get an iPad back from a director who possibly maybe had transitioned over to another device or something and doesn't recall what their password is, or then it's very difficult for us to unlock that device and we end up spending, you know, we could spend a day or two of staff time trying to resolve that issue. You know, we'll just make a judgment call. If we get one back and we don't know the password, then just economically it's easier just to go buy another one and move forward. So my recommendation is we just maintain the current policy.
Thank you. Thank you, Trey. And I think as we looked at the different proposals and what was going on with those and how difficult they were to maybe manage in the future, I think that you're correct. We're trying to probably maybe solve a problem that doesn't truly exist. I know that in regards to the city, as the iPads are issued to the council members, the city clerk maintains the passwords and stuff for those iPads and allows the, of course, the council members to use them for city business as they deem it. By that way, if there's updates or there's issues and whatnot, they have the passwords in order to maintain them and unlock them, and when they receive them back, to get them cleaned up. So, if there's, I guess a will of the board here, we don't have to do anything in regards to a motion and just leave it as it is today, because that stays in place. Any comments from the board? So I would suggest that we continue with the current policies, and if with that, I don't think there's any motions necessary. Any objections? Hearing, seeing none. Thank you.
Chair?
Yes. Mr.
Chair, I did have a really quick question. This might be an administrative question. Was there a previous motion directing staff to do something on that particular matter?
I think there was a motion to bring forward some options, and if we don't want to accept those options, we don't have to do anything.
Okay.
And so I think, as a point of order, we're probably fine without moving forward with that.
Sure.
Just from my own standpoint, I have my own iPad and I choose to use that. That way CEPA isn't obligated to anything, and I can carry those things to me. And I also use those iPads for other business or reading or other things that I do with them. So, for you board members that, would assume to use your own devices, I think that's great. Maybe there is some things that we can do to help out with that in maybe areas where there might be a high cost or something. But, for the most part, I'm just happy myself to utilize my own resources to access the meetings and stay in touch. So, if there are those that don't have those resources, then I think reach out to CEPA and we can able to take care of that issue. All right. So, it is 11:44. We have about 15 minutes before we get in to lunch. I don't know if it's the board's wishes to have an early lunch or if we should go ahead and take care of at least one item in new business, and then we just move on as the time allows. So the next order of business is 7A, consideration and approval of amendment number 3 to CEPA lease agreement with Ketchikan Gateway Borough. There is a motion before us. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Chair.
I move to authorize CEPA CEO to enter into agreement number 3, or amendment number 3, to the lease agreement between CEPA and the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, KGB, provided in the September 9th, 2021 board packet, for the lease of CEPA's offices in the KGB building on a month-to-month basis from January 16, 2022 through January 15, 2023, under the terms set forth in Amendment Number 3.
I'll second that, Prasanka.
Thank you. Trey, do you have anything to add to the information, or just you want to point out to us?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is in direct response to the CEPA office building, potential timing for construction. Now, with the COVID and, the escalation in building costs, and now they are moderating a fair amount. And we just anticipate there's no way we would get it constructed by the end of the year. So we wanted to be proactive. We had a particular date that we had to respond to the borough in order to gain a lease extension. And then we've worked in flexibility of a month to month, so we can you know, really dial that in tight if we need to with regard to the transition and completion of the office building. So that's what this is for. And you know, and I think, you know, their escalation in rent's been pretty reasonable over the years.
Thank you. Anybody, any comments? Yes, Jeremy.
Apologize, Mr. Chair. I need a ruling from the chair with regard to a potential conflict of interest on this. I apologize. I did not mention it at the beginning of the meeting. I currently am a member of the Borough Assembly. All leases and things of these natures do go through the Borough Manager's office, but this may be an item that could potentially come before the Borough Assembly, and I just wanted to get a ruling from the chair if there's a conflict.
So these are pretty standard operating things. They are normal business for the borough, and as an assembly member, I don't think that excludes you from being involved in this discussion or voting on this item at this time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, point of order. I tend to disagree with that. Is that something that we do here if a board member disagrees with a ruling?
Absolutely. It can be a ruling of the majority of the voting members in order to determine whether there's a conflict or not. But as chairman...
Mr. Chair, could I ask the attorney to weigh in? Do we have specific conflict language, and does it have to be a specific benefit to the member, or does it have to just show potential influence?
Joel.
Yes, I don't have those right in front of me, but I guess my inclination is that rather than have Jeremy vote, it might be appropriate if you just simply recuse yourself rather than request approval of the chair to do it, to excuse your conflict. I think it would be acceptable to simply recuse yourself from voting.
Thank you, Joel.
Just a suggestion to avoid the issue.
Sharon, would we have a quorum?
We would, yes.
Without objection, I would recuse myself from voting on this matter.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Hearing and seeing none, Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Well, Prasanka?
Yes.
Siebertson?
Yes.
Gillings?
Yes.
And Hagerman?
Yes.
Thank you.
That motion passes. Brings us on to item B, consideration and approval of resolution 2021-079 in First Amendment to documentation retention policies.
You want me to discuss this, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Okay. So this, real simple. We had, there's two issues, with our, document retention policy that, this, is attempting to, address. The first being that in the original policy, we said we were going to review it on an annual basis. And this is a huge document with a lot of detail, and it's and the elements really don't change that often. And so we're recommending that the policy review period be extended to every five years. And then the other element is just adoption of the actual retention records retention schedule, which is in your packets, that identifies every specific type of document and how long we keep it. And we're just wanting the board to acknowledge and accept that as well.
So was there a motion attached to this, Trey, or is it just four hands for approval?
I think it's a resolution on page 63.
Yeah, it's just a simple, we need a simple motion to approve resolution 2021-079.
So do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move to adopt resolution number 2021-079.
Prasanka, I second that.
It has been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing and seeing none. Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Hagerman?
Yes.
Prasanka?
Yes.
Bynum?
Yes.
Hubertson?
Yes.
And Skillings?
Yes.
Thank you.
So with that, I think that I will call for a recess for lunch because I think there's going to be some discussions and considerations in regards to the next item in vegetation management plan. So we will be back at 1. I think that's what our schedule dictates. So without objection, I will go ahead and ask that we recess until 1 o'clock and come back after lunch. Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, we will stand in recess.
Thank you.